Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 265. It's Monday, July 22nd. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, folks, well, let's start up with a 2024 state scorecard on women's health and reproductive care. This is from the Commonwealth Fund. First, I'm going to do an overview of the situation in the United States, and then I'm going to do some info on the state profile specifically. The health of women in the United States is in a perilous place. Deaths from preventable causes are on the rise, and deep inequities persist, leading to stark racial differences in maternal mortality and deaths from breast and cervical cancers. Despite a small rebound in white women's life expectancy in 2022, it remains at its lowest since 2006. These troubling health trends are occurring while women are experiencing the consequences of state policy choices and judicial decisions that limit their access to a full range of health care services and reproductive care. 10 states have yet to expand eligibility for Medicaid, leaving nearly 800,000 women uninsured. A highly variable state-by-state approach to the unwinding of the pandemic-era Medicaid coverage has left millions of women either newly uninsured or with significant gaps in their coverage. Tighter limits and additional bans on abortion are certain to drive more maternal and reproductive health care providers to shut down or leave their states, deepening the crisis of access to maternity care. Abortion bans threaten America's future access to care across all medical specialties. In fact, since 2022, medical residency applications in states with bans have declined by more than those in other states. Clearly, women's health is under threat. That's why the Commonwealth Fund has developed the first-ever state scorecard to track trends in women's health over time and document how policy choices and judicial decisions may impact women's access to timely health care. Our state's scorecard of women's health and reproductive care uses the most recent data to assess how well the healthcare system is working for women in every U.S. state. We measured performance by 32 different metrics across three areas: health outcomes, healthcare quality and prevention, and coverage, access, and affordability. This report presents state rankings for each area. Okay, so let's go and see how it's happening with women's health and reproductive care in Ohio. First of all, in this Commonwealth Fund ranking, Ohio ranks number 29th overall out of 51, and includes DC as well. So we're below average, although honestly, in the wide range of report cards on a variety of public health issues, this is actually better than Ohio usually ranks. So I suppose that's some good news. But let's see, on those three areas that it covered, Ohio ranked 35th on health and reproductive care outcomes. It ranked 29th on coverage, access, and affordability, and 30th on healthcare quality and prevention. Okay, so of those many metrics, what I'm going to do is just highlight those ones where whether we're either in the top one-third of states or the bottom one-third of states. Unfortunately, there's only one indicator that we're in the top one-third. The rest of them are in the bottom third. So under health outcomes, infant mortality, Ohio ranks 44th out of 51. And all-cause mortality For women age 15 to 44, we rank 37th out of 51 in Ohio. Percent of women ages 18 to 64 who report having 14 or more poor mental health days in the past month. That's 24% of women age 18 to 64 reporting 14 or more mental health days in the past month. And that ranks 44th out of 51. And under the category of coverage, access, and affordability, this is the one thing we ranked in the top third was percent of women age 19 to 64 without health insurance coverage. We had only 6% of women who didn't have health insurance coverage in that age group. And this was 15th out of 51 states in D.C. And in the third category, we have two additional ones under coverage, access, and affordability that we were in the bottom third. Share of in-hospital births in state with self-pay insurance payment source. Yeah, that's not very good. We are 40th of 51. And abortion clinics per capita for women age 15 to 44, we were ranked 37th of 51. And under healthcare quality and prevention, percent of women age 65 and older who ever received a pneumonia vaccine, we were ranked 38th out of 51. So overall ranked 29th, and we have a long way to go. Maybe we'll get the award for most improved at some point. Okay, well, next up, let's broaden our lens and go beyond Ohio and the U.S. and go globally and look at women's health. So from Hologic, there's the Global Women's Health Index. I'm just going to highlight a few of the key findings, which are pretty hard-hitting. First of all, emotional health is getting worse, with notable gaps between men and women. Women told us that during a lot of the day yesterday, they experienced worry. That's 42% of women, 39% stress, 30% sadness, and 25% anger. That's in the previous day. A lot of the day yesterday experiencing one of those things, worry the worst at 42%. And maybe there's good reason why. Some of the other stats, 1 in 3 women, that's nearly 1 billion women on the planet, spent a lot of the previous day in physical pain. And the percentage of women struggling to afford food and shelter has increased by 50% in the last decade. And lastly, but not least, more than 4 in 10 women aged 15 to 24 don't feel safe walking alone at night. I would offer that as a really good metric for safety in our society, is that young women should be able to walk around safely alone at night without fear. All in all, the researchers consider this a crisis in women's health. Okay, well, next up, let's return to the United States and drill down to one particular women's health issue. This from NPR. The pros and cons of mammograms should be explained to women, study says. New research makes a case for educating women in their 40s who've been caught in the crossfire of a decades-long debate about whether to be screened for breast cancer with mammograms, about the harms as well as the benefits of the exam. After a nationally representative sample of U.S. women between the ages of 39 and 49 learned about the pros and cons of mammography, more than twice as many elected to wait until they turned 50 to get screened, a study in the Annals of Internal Medicine found. Most women have absorbed the widely broadcast message that screening mammography saves lives by the time they enter middle age. But many remain unaware of the cost of routine screening in their 1940s, that is, in false positive results, unnecessary biopsies, anxiety, and debilitating treatment for tumors that left alone would do no harm. In an ideal world, all women would get this information and then get to have their further questions answered by their doctor and come up with a screening plan that is right for them, given their preferences, their values, and their risk level, said social psychologist Laura Scherer, the study's lead author and associate professor of research at the University of Colorado School of Medicine. Of the nearly 500 women surveyed, only 8% initially said they wanted to wait until they turned 50 to get a mammogram. After researchers informed the women of the benefits and harms, 18% said they would wait until age 50. Learning about the downsides of mammograms did not discourage women from wanting to get the test at some point, the study showed. The benefits and harms of mammography came as a surprise to nearly half of the study's participants. More than one quarter said that they learned from the study about overdiagnosis differed from what their doctors had told them. I think most people are completely unaware of the risks associated with screening because we've had 30 to 40 years of public health messaging campaign. Go out and get your mammogram and everything will be fine, she said. The National Cancer Institute estimates that more than 300,000 women will be diagnosed with breast cancer and over 42,000 will die in the U.S. this year. Incidence rates have been creeping up by about 1% a year, while death rates have been falling a little more than 1% a year. For the past 28 years, the influential U.S. Preventive Services Task Force has been flip-flopping on its recommendation about when women should begin mammography screening. From 1996 until 2002, the independent panel of volunteer medical experts who help guide physicians, insurers, and policymakers said women should begin screening at age 50. In 2002, the task force said women in their 40s should be screened every year or two. In 2009, it said 40-something women should decide whether to get mammograms based on their health history and individual preferences. The new study was conducted in 2022 when the task force guidelines called for women in their 40s to make individual decisions. In 2024, the panel returned to saying that all women between the ages of 40 and 74 should be screened with mammograms every other year. Rising breast cancer rates in younger women, as well as models showing the number of lives that screening might save, especially among black women, drove the push for earlier screening. An editorial accompanying the new study stresses the need for education about mammography and the value of shared decision-making between clinicians and patients. For an informed decision to be made, the harms of overdiagnosis, defined as diagnosis of asymptomatic cancer that would not harm the patient in the future, must be communicated. So the bottom line is we need more shared decision-making, communication, education, and women are perfectly capable of making a decision that works for them. Okay, next up I have a story on vapes. This from Medical Express. FDA allows marketing of Vuse tobacco-flavored vapes. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration authorized the sale of the country's best-selling e-cigarette. The agency's decision only applies to several tobacco-flavored versions of the reusable product sold as Vuse. In January 2023, the FDA rejected R.J. Reynolds' application for its more popular menthol flavor, but the company has challenged that ruling in court. Last month, the FDA granted competitor Enjoy the first authorization for a menthol-flavored e-cigarette. That vaping brand is controlled by tobacco giant Altria. Despite the Vuse authorization, the FDA stresses that e-cigarettes are far from safe. All tobacco products are harmful and potentially addictive, the agency said in a news release announcing the decision. Those who do not use tobacco products, especially young people, should not start. In its decision, the agency noted that tobacco-flavored e-cigarettes do not hold the same appeal among youth that fruit and candy-flavored vaping products do. While FDA remains concerned about the risk of youth use of all e-cigarettes, youth are less likely to use tobacco-flavored e-cigarette products compared to other flavors. According to the 2023 National Youth Tobacco Survey, Vuse was among the most commonly reported brands used by middle and high school students currently using e-cigarettes. However, only 6.4% of students who currently use e-cigarettes reported using tobacco-flavored products. To further discourage vaping among teens and adolescents, the FDA added that it has placed tough marketing restrictions on the Vuse products to guard against youth access and exposure. In the past year, Vuse made up 40% of U.S. vaping sales, the Associated Press reported. Most sales are for Vuse menthol products, which remain available under a court order while Reynolds challenges the FDA's menthol ruling. Some brands like Vuse have been sold in the United States for years, awaiting FDA action on their scientific applications. The market also includes thousands of fruit and candy-flavored products from China that are illegal but are still sold in convenience stores and vape shops. The FDA missed a self-imposed court deadline last month to wrap up its years-long review of major vaping brands. Juul's products remain under federal review, although FDA recently rescinded a 2022 order that would have forced products off the market. That order never took effect because FDA regulators initially agreed to place it on hold following a legal challenge by Juul. More than 26 million applications for vaping products have been rejected by the FDA, with only a handful of products authorized to help smokers so far. I still am just stunned. I've seen this reported several places, so I'm assuming that this isn't a typo. 26 million applications for vaping products. We only have 350 million people in the nation. And when 27 million applications for separate vaping products, that is insane. Perhaps the regulatory approach of the vape manufacturers is flood the zone. Okay, well, next up, you may not be a vapor, but there's more than one way to inhale volatile compounds. This from the Environmental Health Network. Heat can increase air pollution inside cars by up to 40,000 times. The materials in car cabins can release high levels of semi-volatile organic compounds, a group of potentially endocrine-disrupting chemicals, into the surrounding air, according to a new study published in the Science of the Total Environment. Nine different semi-volatile organic compounds were detected in the air and dust of car interiors, including at least five chemicals that had never previously been reported in car cabin air. The concentration of these compounds increased at higher temperatures, with particle levels increasing as much as 40,000 times at 80 degrees Celsius. Turning on the ventilation system effectively reduced chemical exposure, lowering the level of these gases by as much as 90%. Key quote here, it is recommended to ventilate a warm car before entering and have the ventilation on during driving, as both temperature and ventilation have a significant impact on semi-volatile organic compounds. Why does all this matter? Because of their roles as flame retardants and plasticizers. The same compounds present in car interiors are used in many everyday textiles and plastics. These semi-volatile organic compounds are not chemically bound to their materials, causing them to release throughout the entire lifetime of whatever product they're in. While this study points to steps individuals can take to reduce their own exposure, the presence of previously unreported semi-volatile organic compounds highlights the need for more testing and regulation that accounts for consumers' experience of large mixtures of potentially harmful chemicals. And in more news of environmental toxicity, this from the Environmental Health Network, new study shows fashion industry's plastic waste problem. The fashion industry is responsible for millions of tons of plastic waste, much of which ends up polluting the environment due to improper management. A study revealed that the fashion industry produced over 20 million tons of plastic waste in 2019, of a total of about 400 million tons of plastic waste worldwide. Synthetic fabrics like polyester, nylon, and acrylic were the largest contributors, accounting for about 90% of the waste. Much of this plastic pollution occurs in lower-income countries where discarded clothes end up, exacerbating environmental issues. Why does all this matter? This isn't just about the eyesores of a landfill. These microplastics are seeping in our water, soil, and ultimately, our food chain. And it's another example where, you know, waste from the first world is often transferred to the rest of the world, the two-thirds world, the third world, so to speak. So this is a good plug for reduce, reuse, recycle. And of course, if you're buying clothes, buy natural fibers rather than synthetic fabrics. And of course, when the science comes to bear about environmental toxicities, there's always some feet draggers as far as making a change towards better health. This from the Environmental Health Network. Pentagon seeks more time to replace toxic firefighting foam. The Pentagon plans to request an extension to phase out toxic firefighting foam containing forever chemicals, despite a congressional deadline. The Department of Defense says it needs more time, possibly until 2026, to switch from PFAS-based firefighting foam to safer alternatives. Challenges like high costs, equipment changes, and training hinder the transition to fluorine-free foam. PFAS chemicals are linked to serious health issues like cancer and lower birth weights, leading to significant soil and water contamination at military sites. And the key quote here, there are market-ready, PFAS-free firefighting foams that are safe and effective and meet the Department of Defense's new standards for foams. Decades of use of PFAS-laden foams have made the military sites some of the most contaminated hotspots for PFAS pollution. That's the Vice President of Governmental Affairs for the Environmental Working Group. Why this matters? It's a classic case of balancing immediate operational needs with long-term health and environmental consequences. A balancing act that keeps getting more precarious as new studies pile up, showing just how damaging these forever chemicals can be. Okay, well, next up, let's switch to a few healthcare stories. This first one from Stateline. In the 10 states that have not expanded Medicaid, 1.6 million can't afford health insurance. Nearly one of every five uninsured working age adults across the 10 states that have not expanded Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act are, according to a new analysis, stuck in healthcare limbo known as a coverage gap. That means they earn too much money to receive Medicaid, but not enough to qualify for financial help to purchase their own plan on the marketplace. In Alabama and Mississippi, for instance, more than a quarter of uninsured working age adults are left with no affordable pathways to health coverage, according to an analysis from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, a progressive think tank that researches federal and state budget issues. Overall, 1.6 million adults between the ages of 19 and 64 face a situation in non-expansion states. They are all people with incomes below the federal poverty level, and yet they have no financial assistance or coverage, said Gideon Lukens, senior fellow and director of research and data analysis with the organization's health policy team. The analysis also found that more than 60% of those who fall into this gap are people of color. Latino people accounted for 35%, black residents about 24%, and Asian folks account for 2%. Mississippi State Rep. Robert Johnson, a Democrat, said the lack of insurance coverage contributes to other problems, such as the closures of hospitals that have to cover the cost of treating uninsured patients in all types of communities. This is not a conservative or liberal issue. This is about the people that we represent in the state of Mississippi, whether they be black or white, Johnson said in an interview. This is a life or death issue, not just for individuals, but for whole communities. So what's this coverage gap? The Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, was enacted in 2010, but 10 states have not expanded Medicaid, the federal state program that provides health care for low-income people. Those 10 states are Alabama, Florida, Georgia, Kansas, Mississippi, South Carolina, Tennessee, Texas, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. The Affordable Care Act allows states to expand Medicaid to cover people up to 138% of the federal poverty line. The cost of insuring more people would be paid for primarily with federal funds and a smaller state match. People who earned more than that could receive tax credits to subsidize health insurance costs. But in the states that didn't expand, many people with low incomes were left without affordable options. Jennifer Tolbert, deputy director of the program on Medicaid and the uninsured at the nonprofit health research organization Kaiser Family Foundation, told Stateline most people in the coverage gap have jobs but may work in industries and for employers that are much less likely to provide health insurance coverage, such as the service industry or construction. In Alabama, for example, people are only eligible for Medicaid if they earn at or below 18% of the federal poverty line. Yikes. About $4,678 a year for a three-person household. Oh my god, 18% of the federal poverty line. Whoa. But health insurance cost subsidies would only kick in for people earning at 100% of the federal poverty line, which means those in the coverage gap between 18 and 100% of the federal poverty may be stuck with premiums at upwards of hundreds of dollars a month if they got a marketplace plan. Of course, hundreds of dollars a month if you're only making several thousand dollars a year, you know, could very well be all or most of your entire income. And of course, all this goes back to a Supreme Court decision that said that the federal government cannot expand Medicare in the states without the state's approval. And there was a longer, much longer litany of states that hadn't approved it. But over the many years since the ACA has been passed, a lot of states have gotten wise and realized it's a really good deal on a lot of fronts. But there's still 10 states that are holdouts. And in another story on healthcare affordability, this from Medical Express, new figures reveal more Americans struggling to afford healthcare. The percentage of Americans who can afford and access prescription drugs and quality healthcare stands at a new low of 55%, a six-point decline since 2022, according to the West Health Gallup Healthcare Affordability Index. The index was developed in 2021 to track the percentage of Americans who say that they have avoided medical care or not filled prescription medications in the last 3 months, and whether they believe they could afford care if they needed it today. The downturn is largely attributed to two groups. That is adults aged 50 to 64, which dropped 8 points to 55%, and those aged 65 and older down 8 points to 71%. A troubling sign since Medicare eligibility for most Americans begins at 65. The percentage of adults under 50 who could readily afford health care was at the lowest of any age group at 47%, a 5-point decline since 2022. So that means adults under age 50, most people cannot readily afford health care, the majority of that population. For the index, researchers grouped Americans into one of the following three categories, depending on how they reported their ease or difficulty paying for and accessing medical care, including prescribed drugs. Cost secure, no recent problems with affording and accessing health care and prescriptions. Cost insecure, recently unable to either pay for care or medicine or unable to access it. And cost desperate, recently unable to pay for care and medicine and lack immediate access to quality care. 45% of the American adults report struggling to cover their medical bills and are either cost insecure or cost desperate. According to the recently released West Gallup Poll Health 2024 survey on aging in America, an estimated 72 million, or nearly 1 in 3 American adults, did not seek needed health care in the prior 3 months due to cost, including an estimated 8 million Americans aged 65 and older. Nearly 1/3 were concerned about their ability to pay for prescription drugs in the next 12 months, up from 25% in 2022. Healthcare doesn't do you much good if you can't access it or afford it. And in one more story about healthcare affordability, this from Axios, medical debt fuels mental health treatment gap. As many as 1 in 4 U.S. adults with depression and anxiety can't pay their medical bills, a situation that could be limiting their ability to get timely psychiatric care, Johns Hopkins researchers found. Fewer than half of all U.S. adults with mental disorders receive treatment, and the findings show that those with common behavioral disorders face high out-of-pocket costs because many psychiatrists don't even participate in insurance networks. Medical debt was linked with more than a 2-fold increase in delayed or foregone treatment for mental disorders among the more than 27,600 adults surveyed, the researchers wrote in JAMA Psychiatry. Between 19 and 27% reported they had medical debt over the past year. Efforts to relieve some of the debt burden could actually worsen mental health if the assistance is insufficient and winds up amplifying a patient's feelings of distress. That's very distressing that our system is so fragmented and so hard to access that even attempting could actually just increase your distress because you fall short of being able to get what you need. In somewhat related news, this from Axios, suicide hotline awareness lags 2 years in. Many Americans still don't know about 988, the revamped National Suicide Hotline, according to a new polling from Ipsos on behalf of the National Alliance of Mental Illness. Why it matters? 988 launched 2 years ago, and while 67% of U.S. adults say they've heard of the hotline, only 23% say they're at least somewhat familiar with it. That's slightly higher than last June, when just 17% of adults reported being familiar. 72% of the nearly 2,000 U.S. adults surveyed in June said they felt comfortable going to a 988 counselor if they or a loved one needed help during a mental health crisis, but about half of respondents said they weren't sure when a situation is serious enough to call 988. The federal government has started to run awareness campaigns around 988 after early concerns that advertising the hotline could push it past capacity. Official plans to continue outreach this year. So if you're having a mental health crisis, just call 988 and you can get some help. And if in doubt, make the call. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. And next up, a mental health story for parents, this from Medical Express. Attention parents, your teens aren't coping nearly as well as you think they are. Most U.S. teens aren't always getting the social and emotional support they need, and most of their parents have no idea, according to a new report from the CDC. In a nationwide survey conducted after the most isolating period of the COVID-19 pandemic, only 28% of adolescents between the ages of 12 and 17 said they always received the social and emotional support they needed. However, 77% of parents who responded to a related survey said they thought their children always had that support. At the other end of the spectrum, 20% of the teens said they rarely or never had enough social and emotional support. That realization was shared by just 3% of their parents, according to the report published by the CDC's National Center for Health Statistics. This perception gap was shared to some extent by families in all racial and ethnic categories and across all levels of household income, the CDC statisticians found. The same was true for families with teen girls and for families with teen boys. Parents with college or advanced degrees underestimated their teens' need for social and emotional support, as did parents with high school diploma or less. Likewise, parents misjudge their kids' feelings regardless of whether they were raising their family in large cities, rural areas, and communities in between, the researchers reported. In part, those struggles can be traced to the fact that, compared with their predecessors, today's teens spend less time hanging out with their friends in person and more time communicating through smartphones and other digital devices. That type of asynchronous communication can make people feel anxious as they wait for a reply. What's more, reading someone's words instead of hearing them spoken face-to-face doesn't feel as emotionally deep. It may be tempting to dismiss the teen survey response as a typical adolescent angst, but the CDC researchers found significant links between the frequency with which teens wish they had more social and emotional support and their physical and mental health. For instance, 14% of those who said they sometimes, rarely, or never got the support they needed described their physical health as fair or poor, comparing to only 5% of those who always or usually felt socially and emotionally supported. In addition, 67% of those with less social and emotional support rated their sleep quality as poor, compared to 37% of those with more support. Among those who sometimes, rarely, or never received the social and emotional support they needed, 33% had signs of anxiety, 31% had symptoms of depression, and 14% had very low life satisfaction. The corresponding figures for those who always or usually had the social and emotional support they needed were 13% for anxiety, compared to the 33% without, 8% for symptoms of depression, compared to the 31% without, and 1% for very low life satisfaction, compared to 14% of those without. Emotional and social support is a key part of everyone's health, particularly adolescents. Okay, well, last up in the regular reporting, I want to do an interesting story from the American Journal of Public Health, and it's about access to firearms, which of course is a huge problem, as we have pretty much easy access for just about everybody in this country for a variety of firearms. And also that, like many public health problems, there are a lot of things that go in to prevent a particular outcome, firearm injuries or deaths. And sometimes we do these little things thinking they're going to have a much bigger effect, but you have to do quite a bit. So this particular research is a good example of kind of parsing out a particular policy area and what effect it may have on gun violence. State minimum age firearm purchase laws by themselves don't prevent youth suicide. Suicide is the leading cause of gun deaths in the United States, accounting for 60% of them. This statistic may be surprising given the overwhelming focus on public mass shootings, which account for less than 1% of gun deaths. Nearly 30,000 Americans die by firearm suicide each year. According to the National Institutes of Mental Health, suicide is the third leading cause of death for Americans age 18 to 20 years, and the rate of youth suicide is rising. To reduce gun violence overall and to protect vulnerable youth from suicide, elected leaders and public health officials should prioritize suicide prevention. Currently, 17 states and the District of Columbia have done that by passing minimum age legislation that prohibits young adults, that is those 18 to 20, from purchasing handguns. Of these, eight also prohibit the sale of long guns, that is, rifles and shotguns. One state prohibits the sale of semi-automatic rifles to purchasers younger than 21 years old. It would seem obvious that state minimum age laws would lower suicide rates among young adults by restricting access to firearms, the most lethal means of suicide by far. This public health approach, so-called means restriction, has strong empirical support. Most people who attempt suicide act on impulse. Restricting access to the means of suicide can save a life at a fleeting moment of crisis. One expert provided this example. When a fence barrier was installed on the Duke Ellington Memorial Bridge in Washington, D.C., suicide deaths on the bridge were reduced by 90%, but it did not increase the rate of attempts at other bridges around the city. Applying this model to firearms should reduce suicide mortality. However, according to research published in the American Journal of Public Health, state laws that prohibit handgun sales to purchasers aged younger than 21 years have only a negligible impact on the suicide rate of young adults. They offer three possible explanations. First, federal law already prohibits the sale of handguns by federally licensed firearms dealers, that is, gun shops, to purchasers younger than 21. However, these laws do not apply to private sellers, for example, families and friends and individuals selling firearms at gun shows and online. The White House recently promulgated a new rule that may limit these private sales. Thus, state laws prohibiting the sale of handguns to young adults relates only to the private sale of handguns. Fewer than 22% of gun purchases are made through a private seller. Only some of those sales are for handguns, and only a small percentage of those involve purchasers younger than 21. Thus, few young adult purchasers are affected by state age restrictions. Second, in states that prohibit the private sale of handguns to young adults, they may still purchase long guns. This may in part explain why the rate of suicide committed with a long gun instead of a handgun is higher among the young adult population. According to the authors, the rate is 37% compared to 25% in the general population. Federal law does not prohibit the sale of long guns to purchasers younger than 21. Thus, state minimum age laws that prohibit the sale of handguns and long guns to young adults may be somewhat more effective than those only focused on handgun sales. The third, and perhaps most important, reason is that 75% of the firearms used by young adults who commit suicide belong to someone else, so the state age restrictions didn't apply. Notably, over 80% of mass shootings in K-12, that is kindergarten to 12th grade schools, also involved a firearm that belonged to someone else. These facts highlight the importance of secure firearm storage in preventing both suicide and mass shootings committed by young adults. Importantly, the authors found that the efficacy of state minimum age laws was significantly increased when accompanied by permit-to-purchase laws. These laws are more restrictive than federal background check laws, which require a dealer to run a form completed by the purchaser through the National Instant Criminal Background Check System to search for disqualifiers, including age. In contrast, permit-to-purchase laws require a would-be purchaser to apply for a permit in person with a local or state law enforcement agency. The permit processing includes taking fingerprints and an enhanced state and federal background check, which may have a deterrent effect on young adults in crisis. In states with only a minimum age law, suicide rates decrease by 12% on average, an average of 2 people per state. In comparison, in states with both a minimum age law and a permit to purchase law, the young adult suicide rate decreased by 39%, and the overall suicide incident rate decreased by 14%. With no effect on the non-firearm suicide rate. Based on these results, the authors conclude that state permit-to-purchase laws represent a promising avenue to reduce young adult suicide. They noted a growing body of research finding that permit-to-purchase laws reduce both suicide and homicide, and 75% of the public support these laws. As these laws vary from state to state, the authors call for more research to understand which provisions are the most effective in reducing suicide, both for young adults and the general population. For example, some states had a permit requirement for handguns only. Extending the permit requirement to long guns may increase the efficacy of these laws. Perhaps the most important of these is secure firearm storage. Research shows that this means-restriction approach reduces all forms of gun violence, including those that threaten our youths, suicide, unintentional gun deaths, and school mass shootings. Government officials, healthcare providers, educators, suicide prevention advocates, gun violence prevention groups, gun owners, and even artists can save lives by promoting the importance of secure firearm storage to their constituencies. I mean, part of the reason why dealing with gun violence is so complicated and resistant to change is just because we have so many guns, more and more every year. You know, we have more guns than people in this country. Restricting the means, it has to kind of tighten the hatches down a little bit more to make sure that not just anybody anywhere can get access to a gun. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, all available online. Just like all the stories I reported on in this episode and previous episodes, you can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. 39 bonus articles this week, so let's get rolling. Number one, health advocates target Philip Morris's U.S. launch of heated tobacco. So the tobacco industry is always up to its old playbook. And they spent over $1 billion developing this new heated tobacco product. And health advocates know that trying to make safe tobacco use is not really a brilliant idea. Bonus article 2. Digital games on vaping devices could lure more youth to nicotine addiction. So I hadn't heard this one before. yikes, they are actually putting digital games on the vaping devices. Some of them, you get points in the game for how many hits of the vape you take. And of course, this is like melding two addictions, gaming and vaping together. Yikes, not good for trying to lure more youth into nicotine addiction. Bonus article 3, study examines profound impact of incarceration on youth health. So this is whether the youth is incarcerated or whether someone in their household is incarcerated, and it has both profound effects on mental health and physical health. Bonus article 4, school-based health centers are a critical component of healthcare for underserved children. So given that our healthcare system is so fragmented and we have so many pockets of vulnerable people, for young folks who are underserved medically, school-based health centers can be a critical component in getting care to them that they need. Bonus Article 5 gets at another vulnerable population. A California medical group treats only homeless patients and has found diverse funding to survive. So California, of course, has one of the largest homeless populations because of the high cost of living. People find themselves without housing. But this group is pioneering a way. You need to be innovative in order to find the funding, but they're able to do it just serving, targeting homeless patients. Bonus Article 6, no asymptomatic bird flu infections found in 35 dairy farm workers exposed. So this is good news in a little series of bird flu stories here. Of course, it's a relatively small study, just 35 dairy farm workers that were exposed, but the good news is they didn't find any evidence of exposure infection of bird flu. It's striking how few people, though, have actually, how many dairy farm workers have actually been tested, though. Bonus Article 7, study suggests earlier U.S.-licensed bird flu vaccines prompt antibodies to current strain. So this is good news because there already are, quote, older bird flu vaccines, and some of those are held in the Strategic National Stockpile, and these apparently prompt antibodies to the strain that's going around, the one that could potentially, you know, jump to humans in mass. So that's good news. In lesser news, a couple stories. Bonus Article 8, heat wave fans spread of bird flu on dairy and poultry farms. So wearing protective gear and also just stirring up the virus is exacerbated when you have heat, and that's not an uncommon situation on dairy and poultry farms. Bonus Article 9, chicken culling and disposal raise concern as bird flu spreads. So when bird flu hits a population of chickens, they cull them, kill them, and have to dispose of them, and that whole process can lead to further transfer of bird flu. Bonus Article 10, USDA maintains bird flu can be eliminated from dairy cows even as doubt mounts among experts. Personally, my prediction is that it'll become endemic in dairy cows in the United States. I think maybe the USDA is engaging in a little bit of obligatory optimism. Of course, if that's your goal is to eliminate it, then I guess you better believe it. But I'm skeptical at this point. Bonus Article 11, long COVID risk has fallen, mostly attributable to vaccination. So this is a good study looking back, you know, having come through the COVID pandemic, and this parses out people that have never been vaccinated versus people that have been vaccinated, and definitely shows that like 78% of the decrease in COVID risk has been due to vaccination rather than, for instance, being exposed to the virus multiple times by getting COVID multiple times and getting antibodies other than through vaccination. Bonus Article 12, how food ads are contributing to the obesity epidemic. This is a good overview of sort of some of the social factors and risk factors for kind of our food system leading to bad health outcomes. And this is from one of my favorite nutrition sites, nutritionfacts.org, and is paired with another article. Bonus Article 13, marketing takes off as obesity soars. A good example of the food industry trying to get more profits. A good analysis of social determinants of health in food illnesses, obesity being one of those. Bonus article 14, the chaos of choice. How do people pick their food products? This is a very interesting example that kind of looks at ways to try to help people pick food products by different labeling, you know, giving them food Nutri-Scores and that kind of stuff. And interestingly, points out that about a third of the people actually will pick a product. If it says it's healthy, they're least likely to choose it because they assume that if something is healthy, it doesn't taste good. And that's a marker for them to actually pick the least healthy foods. Yikes. Of course, that isn't true. True in some cases, but not true generally. Bonus article 15, weight loss linked to improved mood and reduced risk-taking in obese individuals. This is important new research because sometimes people thought that people that actually having a poor mood or risk-taking might actually lead people, be the causal factor to lead people to be obese. But this study actually shows that the direction of causality by having people losing weight and finding that that actually improves mood and reduce risk-taking, that the causality is actually related to the obesity. It's not the mood and risk-taking leading to obesity. Some good news on the dietary front, bonus article 16. Total dietary quality score improved for U.S. children during 2005 to 2020. So this is a rather modest increase, and it's still way below, but we'd like to see it, but a little bit of good news. But things we can't control, which ends up getting into our diets, bonus article 17, tracking tire plastics and tire chemicals from road to plate, a good read to see how the world is connected and how our tires end up in our food. Bonus article 18, Paris Olympics 2024 branded metal bottles recalled for health reasons. This is because they have BPA, which one of those endocrine disruptors at high levels, so they had to recall them. And I thought this was a little ironic because Paris wanted people to swim in the Seine for the actually swimming events, but it's not safe enough. So we got both unsafe water in the river and we've got unsafe water that would be in the branded metal bottles for the Olympics in Paris. Yikes, little irony there. Bonus article 19. Activists demand halt to uranium mining near the Grand Canyon. Of course, the Grand Canyon is a very environmentally sensitive area, and it also impinges upon Native people's rights. So there's a lot of demand that we get rid of uranium mining, which is really just an example of how the need for nuclear weapons or nuclear power can drive other environmental harms than simply just carbon footprints. Bonus article 20. The risks of eyelash extensions aren't pretty, from cornea erosion to cancer-causing glue. So if you or someone you know has eyelash extensions, you might want to take a look at this. Bonus article 21. Thinking about getting a tattoo? You may have to deal with bacterial contaminated inks. So when they tested inks, and these are supposed to be sealed at manufacturing and not have any bacterial contamination, over a third of the samples that they tested showed bacterial contaminated inks. And that's just getting it from the manufacturer. You can also get contamination after it's opened if it's not properly handled, by the tattoo parlor. And bonus article 22, for all of us, as California regulators refuse to enforce new orphan well rules, lawmakers and environmental groups cry foul. So you're supposed to put up a bond when you have an abandoned well or a well that's likely to be abandoned soon so that you have money available to shut that down and make that well safe, these orphan wells. And of course, California, which tends to be more progressive on this, has declined to enforce the rule that requires them to do a bond. Not good. Good read, though. Bonus article 23, exposed. Latino farm workers risk their health working under threat of pesticide exposure. This is a really good long read that shows a lot of new research. We've known for a long time that farm workers are exposed to dangerous pesticides. But this is a great article and a good read if you're not familiar with that and like to learn more. Bonus article 24, DOJ says largest housing provider for migrant kids engage in pervasive sexual abuse. So this is something I'm glad the DOJ has been investigating. And you know, if they're if they're pushing a potential prosecution, that it's very serious and there's a lot of evidence of this. Tragic. Bonus article 25, the prevalence of gambling and problematic gambling worldwide. So worldwide, 1.4% of the adult population engages in problematic gambling. But that's true, 16% of those that are doing online casino or slots gambling. Now, this is a global study, and also so globally and in the U.S., the new sports gambling, which is online, is a new thing that hasn't been covered by this. But because the online casino or slots gambling is so much more addictive than other types of gambling, I suspect that the sports gambling, online sports gambling, fits into that category as well. It's much more dangerous from an addiction point of view. Bonus article 26. The 988 mental health crisis hotline is working. So why doesn't it get the funding it needs? So it's been around 2 years and it's fielded over 10 million calls or communications. They can do text and such as well. Needs more help. But of course, maybe the answer to that question is the next story, bonus article 27. The nation's 911 system is on the brink of its own emergency. So the 911 system actually is over 6,000 different call centers. And this is a kind of fragmented, and there's been a lot of failures where the system goes down, which of course can be very dangerous if you're in a community and you call 911 and there's no answer. Bonus article 28. To overcome the overdose crisis, addiction treatment must be integrated into the healthcare system. Another example of our fragmented system, that addiction is handled separately and not very well integrated into our healthcare system. In a related story on addiction and mental health, bonus article 29, online addiction and mental health treatment companies shown to violate people's privacy. So as healthcare moves increasingly online through telehealth and such, even apps and that type of thing, the issues of people's privacy is a huge concern, and there's almost no good regulation. And if there happen to be a regulation, it's not enforced very well. And a couple of these big online companies actually have contracts with the federal government, and they're violating people's privacy. Need to do something about that. Bonus article 30. Institutional review boards fail in requirement to assess clinical trial scientific merit, putting participants at risk and enabling low-quality research. So these institutional review boards basically are part of the institution, and while they're required to actually look at the scientific merit and make a judgment and actually not allow the low-quality research, they basically pass on doing that. So that's bad enough in itself from the scientific project of getting good quality research, but also clinical trial participants are being put at some risk by being in clinical trials. And generally, the risk and burden that they take is a gift as an advantage to other people who might benefit from the scientific advancements that come from it. But the risk that they take should be a good risk where it's a good quality research program. So institutional review boards need to get your act together. Bonus article 31. As GLP-1 sales surge, insulin users fear pharma corporations will move on without them for greater profits. So the GLP-1 is these Wegovy-like weight loss drugs that are hugely profitable. And insulin, particularly since they haven't charged outrageous prices for insulin, they might decide just to leave people who need insulin without the availability to get insulin, just stop producing it, because they can get huge profits by moving on to other drugs. Bonus article 32. The real reason drug costs are so high in America, well, it's a lot of reasons, but a big one is pharmacy benefit managers. This is a really good article to understand how healthcare lawyers restructure corporations. They have this, you know, middlemen of pharmacy benefit managers that free them up from the caps on money being used for profits as opposed to actually going to benefit to the people that they're supposed to be serving. And that's unlimited with these intermediate middle manager pharmacy benefit managers. Yeah, crazy tax lawyers, basically. Bonus article 33. Nurse survey signals some improvements, though retention's still a big problem. So as I reported last week, that physicians showed a slight increase in a little bit less burnout and likely to leave the job. Nurses have some similar improvements, but job retention is still a huge problem in healthcare. Bonus article 34. feds tighten insurance broker access to healthcare.gov to thwart rogue signups. So I reported on this, where insurance brokers were actually illegally signing up people without their knowledge because they get nice little commissions. So the feds have tightened the screws down on that to make that much, much more difficult to do. And this happened very quickly, which you don't often see. You know, government isn't known for being the quickest, but they acted very quickly on this, and hopefully that'll bring an end to most of that. Bonus Article 35. U.S. maternal mortality solutions must include addressing intimate partner violence. So domestic violence is a huge problem and a risk factor and a leading cause of death for perinatal maternal mortality, meaning within, you know, during pregnancy or the first year after birth. And oftentimes we want to reduce it down to healthcare, but this gets back to the social determinants. You need to deal with intimate partner violence if you want to deal with the U.S. maternity mortality crisis in this country. Bonus Article 36. The U.S. presidential election of 2024 is a public health emergency. This is an editorial by the editor-in-chief of the American Journal of Public Health and is a good overview of what's at stake in the next election for public health. And also on the political front, bonus Article 37, at Trump's GOP convention, there was little to be heard on health and healthcare. And related to that as well, 38, Vance quietly tried to shape public health agenda in Congress. So, of course, he's our Ohio senator, might be interested in that reason alone, but as the new VP running mate for Trump, you might want to know what he has to do, what his concerns are and agenda is for public health and health. Bonus Article 39, last but not least, is there a wrong way to talk about climate change? Beware of conversations defined by the fossil fuel industry's terms and agenda. So part of the answers that we get depend on the questions, and we should not be letting the fossil fuel industry define the terms or the agenda. You can read these and all the other articles I reported on in this issue and those before by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London, and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some justice.